today. One bill that was listed on the agenda will not be heard, and I believe all of the individuals were notified. That Senate Bill 170, dealing with massage therapists. There have been a couple of, there are some amendments and some things that we were not aware of at the time we scheduled it. So if anyone is here for that, I just wanted to let you know early the bill will not be heard. We're going to do public hearing and work sessions, hopefully on the other two bills. We have a public hearing scheduled for Senate Bill 60 and 61. We probably could have done a public hearing, which we didn't list, so we can't do, but we will have the public hearing. I think they're fairly simple, and then we'll bring those back. So the first public hearing that we will have, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 42. And could you give us a kind of a review of Senate Bill 42, very briefly?
Senate Bill 42 directs the Department of Human Services to adopt rules to grant exceptions to the requirements that all licensed adult foster homes have a provider or substitute caregiver living in the home and a provider or caregiver on duty 24 hours per day. It declares an emergency effect on passage.
Okay. Department of Human Services, Mary Lee Fay, would you come forward, please?
Good afternoon. Kira Morissette, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 42. You have written testimony that's being distributed from me right now, so let me summarize why we're in support of this bill. Senate Bill 42 makes a couple changes. The first is it allows the department to establish criteria under which a resident who is in an adult foster home could be allowed to be in the home for a short amount of time without supervision. Primarily, this is a reinstatement of what we have been practicing for people with developmental disabilities. Prior to 2005, within our rules, we had exceptions that we operated and had criteria for assessing individuals' ability to stay for a short amount of times without having to have the direct supervision of the foster provider. In 2005, we had an interpretation from legislative council that the statutory authority to allow this exception wasn't in place. So this bill allows us to reinstate that. It allows us to put together administrative rules, creating the exception and a policy in which we would review any applicant to both assess their ability to manage some emergency situations and look at the length of time that they'd be staying alone. This is primarily persons with in the addictions and mental health services have some of these exceptions. This is primarily developmental disabilities within seniors and people with disabilities. The second thing that this bill does is also requires the department to write rules permitting exceptions to the requirement that a provider or a resident manager live in the home. Again, this is primarily directed towards those foster homes that support adults and persons with physical disabilities, and they are truly exceptions. In some cases, individuals who might be living in a home with ventilator support are requiring more shift care than an actual person, resident manager, living in the home. And so it allows the department to, again, create rules in where those circumstances can exist. So this bill focuses more on the seniors and persons with physical disabilities side than the rest of the department. So it accomplishes those two things. Because of those, we're in support of this bill. We believe that it is a policy that makes sense and that is within the department's ability to carry out without additional costs. Any questions?
Yes, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes.
Thank
Senator
you.
Bond Sanders.
We always need to look at the safety. And when I think of a person with developmental disabilities, there would be some with developmental disabilities that could not be left alone. And so there are some that could be left alone. Is that what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, as I said, this actually reinstates the process. And in the past, out of about 1,500 people who were in foster care and developmental disabilities, we had authorized plans for 80 people. So it's a small number of individuals, and they are many of the scenarios are people who might not want to go with a foster provider to the movie when everyone else is going, or go shopping, or may come home from their work at a different schedule and allows them to be at home for an hour or two before the provider. But they have to demonstrate the ability to respond to an emergency, know how to dial 911. There's a series of things that we require of the plan.
That I just, Mr. Chair, yeah, that's what I wanted to have clarified, because I would, even with, when you say adults with some with dementia, that, I mean, they would never be left alone.
And that is why this particular portion of the bill really has targeted itself more towards persons with developmental disabilities and some individuals in the addictions mental health arena.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I might add that when this bill was originally written, the developmental disability community was not, I don't think, part of that agency or part of the mix. It came later, and there was a waiver given in certain cases. But when the law was asked to be reviewed by the Attorney General found that the letter of the law did not allow a certain segment to receive a waiver. And there was nothing short of a statute change that could correct it. So this, it's an interesting thing. But we're going to call up the two experts about on this issue, Gretchen Thielman and Tim Baxter. Would you please come up and testify? And believe me, they are experts. Now remember that we're probably going to support this, so don't do anything to make us want to vote no. So control yourself.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Tim Baxter. I work for Lane County Law and Advocacy Center in Eugene. It's a nonprofit legal service for low-income folks. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 42. I really have very little to add to what Ms. Fay said. I believe that the bill as it stands and as Ms. Fay has testified to is sufficient. I would add one thing only, if I may. I think it would be helpful, and I think Ms. Fay all but said this, but I think it would be helpful to make it clear if this is Ms. DHS's understanding and the committee's intention that this bill is designed to allow a system of home alone exceptions, variances, only for folks with developmental disabilities and mental health needs, addiction and mental health services, that it is not a bill intended to apply to the elderly and the physically disabled that are under jurisdiction of DHS. There has been some concern raised that somehow, in some manner that's not clear to me, that there might be some kind of leeching over into other areas than the developmental disabilities area. However, Ms. Fay is correct in saying that what we're intending to do is to put it back the way it used to be before the Attorney General weighed in with its opinion. With that, I really have nothing more to add. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want, just to put it on the record, before the AG's opinion changed this program, was there any problems with it?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, there were no reported problems, at least within my purview of knowledge. I believe, conversely, that for something between 10 and 15 years, the system worked flawlessly. Nobody's house burned down. I don't think even anybody's dinner got spoiled on the stove.
Okay, Mr. Chair, my dinner gets spoiled on the stove all the time, especially when I'm cooking. But I just wanted to put it on the record because I think what we're attempting to do and what this bill will do is take us back to what used to be status quo and it worked fine.
I will add one thing because of the emails that have been going back and forth that you're referring to concerning the possible confusion. This bill, interestingly, is going to be heard in the House side on Friday. It may have an amendment that clarifies the point that you're making. And in that case, each bill, if each does pass the respective houses, will go to the conference committee, which is going to be interesting because usually that's at the end of the session. But and then that will there will be a similar bill coming back to each house. So we're going to go through the process. That is a concern that came up just recently, that there could be some confusion and leaching over into others, and that should be clarified.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I think maybe one of the questions, and I probably would have brought it up myself, and I don't know what the amendment is, but it just allows the department to set the rules, and the only requirement is that they safeguard residents' health and safety, which is, in effect, rather broad and somewhat vague. Now, everybody here understands what that means, and that's the way it's supposed to be, but I imagine that that's where, if there is any concern, that there's some concern that that was just not exactly specific enough to satisfy.
Well, I met with James Tace, the head of the department, and Pete Shepard, the attorney general, during the interim, and we discussed the ramifications, and there is absolutely no doubt that the waivers apply only to certain cases of the developmentally disabled, and so that this amendment, if it is amended, is, I think, almost redundant. I'm not sure that we needed an amendment, okay. But I think it's very clear, and it has worked successfully for 15 years, and so I'm anxious to hear Ms. Thiel's comments. Oh, I'm sorry, Tim, did you have a comment?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, only to add that at least as Senate Bill 42 was drafted, there is additional language that requires these rules to be drafted in a way that not only will protect health and safety, but also the residents' uninterrupted receipt of services. I would hope that whatever may come out of the House will reflect that also.
Okay. Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, Senator Morissette and all of you. My name is Gretchen Thielman, and I'm a foster care provider in Lane County. I've been a provider for 3 years. And I've worked with this population for 18 years in different aspects. I provide services to two individuals who've been married for 19 years and until 3 years ago lived in their own home. Their names are Tim and Sue Peterson. And when Sue was diagnosed with diabetes, they were forced to move into a foster care situation in order to control and do some training in regards to that. And they both worked very hard to control their health issues. Sue hasn't had any issues with her diabetes and has had a clear bill of health from the doctor at her last two appointments, so she's doing very well. What happened is that these were two of the people who had the variance originally, and they were able to be home alone for 2 hours. And they had to pass all the safety tests to make sure they knew 911. Of course, they'd lived on their own for 12 years, so they passed with flying colors. And being a married couple, it's an issue where they really enjoyed some time alone, and it was really, just like to all of us, it was very important to them. And so when this rule came down, and they were forced to give up that time alone. And so it became a real issue, and it has been in our home. It's put a lot of pressure on us and them to provide situations for them where they have some couple time. So I appreciate your support, and I think I testified to most of you last time about the specifics of the bill, but I'm very supportive of this, and so that's really all I have to say. I appreciate you guys taking a look at it and making this an individual case and treating these people with respect and dignity they deserve.
Gretchen, talk a little bit about how each of them work out of the home separately.
Right. Well, Tim has been in his job for 25 years, and they navigate the LTD bus system every day. He has the system memorized. So if I need to go anywhere on bus, I just ask Tim. He'll tell me which bus to catch and when and where. And Sue also has worked for Winco Foods for 13 years now. So they're very independent. They go out together all day on Saturday and have kind of a date day where they go to a movie and dinner. And so their employment is just another reflection of how independent and determined they are to lead as normal life as possible.
So this, I think, is an interesting case because paradoxically they are very self-sufficient. They work outside of the home independently. They come home. And yet, under this glitch, you were not supposed to, you couldn't leave them alone at home.
Right. And it was difficult because when we made this family arrangement, I have two kids that are 5 and 6 years old, and so it worked out very well because we had a couple times a week where we go to t-ball practice or soccer and they could stay home and have some time by themselves. But that hasn't happened since March. And so it's been really difficult for them. I think it's led to the decision within our family, and Tim and Sue included, that in July they're going to move out into their own place again. And they'll be in an independent living situation with some supports. But the need for privacy that they have is not being met right now under the current rules. And it's also been very difficult for our family to adjust to having to, you know, make a decision. Well, if everybody wants to go, then we can go. But if one person doesn't want to go, then we can't do whatever the activities are. So what's interesting and ironic about this is in order for me to do independence training with them and to put them in a real-life situation where they can practice the skills that they need to be alone, they're going to have to stay in a hotel. And that's legal. So.
Well,
but changing this will fix that.
Interestingly, Gretchen wrote a brilliant brief.
Thank you.
That she presented to Assistant Attorney General Pete Shepard at this very table, and about whether or not the state of Oregon was in compliance with the Federal Disability Act. And it took him a while to figure it out. Well, no, I mean, it really raised a legitimate question. And so he had to go back and take a look at that, and it was something that, you know, I thought was very good. And so she stayed up all night one night and did that, right?
I stayed up all night reading through the Americans with Disabilities Act, yes. Let's try and find something that applied to their situation. So, and I think I did, but mm-hmm. Now that we're here, I don't have to do that.
Okay, good. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gary Lane and Art Towers, would you please come up?
Committee members and Chair, I'm Gary Lane. I'm a foster care provider for mental health, have been since, memory fails me, 1991 or 92. I'm also the president of Adult Care Providers of Oregon, which has members with senior and disabled services, DDS, and mental health providers. I wanted to be very brief since people seem to be lined up behind the bill. I wanted to state why I have found that the bill has been, or that the bill is good. The current situation is a problem. Residents placed in foster care homes are tenants. They pay room and board. As tenants, the current regulations violate landlord-tenant laws. And the reason they do that is because if I need to take my residents out, I load them all up into a van because we can't leave anybody behind. I'm supposed to lock the house, even in freezing weather or very hot weather. If one gets out and goes to the library while we're running doctor's appointments and beats us home, he can't be in the house. Well, I've refused to do that, so I'm in violation of the law or the rules, the interpretation at this stage. But I do that because I think client or resident safety comes before obeying a rule that hasn't been well thought out. In addition, there's problems where the state and local county staff will tell me I can do things like leave them van alone, Albertsons alone, library alone, shoot, maybe even mental health offices in Salem alone, not really, and while I run errands, but I can't leave them home alone. And I was concerned enough about the things that I decided I'd better ask them, well, what about camping? I take my guys camping once or twice a year. So I asked the state and the county, and they said, yes, you can take them camping. And I said, and if some of them want to go into town and others want to sleep or stay in the campground, what then? You know what their answer was? Perfectly okay. So in a situation where they could get lost, they don't have a phone to call for 911, they aren't familiar with who to contact if there is something that comes up that could endanger them, which they're capable of doing, but they wouldn't necessarily know who or why, it's okay to leave them alone, but not in their home where they have emergency services easily available and they're familiar with what's going on and how to, you know, take care of themselves for a short period of time. Now, obviously, they're in a foster home because in the long haul, they can't, but for a short time, they can. In addition, the residents generally voice, irritation that they're inconvenienced. They have to get up from a nap or even late at night. I have two residents that have worked, are working at Laurel Hill Center. They're doing janitorial work, so they get off late, and if they miss their bus or they need a ride because it's really icy like it has been, we live on a hill, I need to go get them. Well, everybody's got to get up, or else I got to let them try to struggle up the hill in icy weather by themselves, which I won't do. The residents have voiced that they dislike the less freedom and the sense that people don't trust them anymore, whereas they were before, because some of these people do work their ways toward independence. Now, how can they do that if they haven't been rehearsing independent behaviors? And the last thing I'd like to say is that federal guidelines for any disabled person are that people are to be placed in the least restrictive environment given their disabilities. For these people, this is more restrictive and odious than it should be. So I am definitely in favor of the new, going back to the old standards because we're correcting this. And by the way, if there's any way to make the law in effect as soon as you pass it instead of waiting till August or January 1 of 2008, mm-hmm. I'm in favor of that.
There's an emergency clause on it.
That's it.
Okay.
Good.
All right.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union, Local 503. We represent more than 10,000 Oregon care providers for the elderly and disabled in in-home care and in nursing homes. And we support wholeheartedly addressing the concern raised by adult foster care providers. We also support Senate Bill 42. We're a little bit nervous about it, but again, we do support the legislation and want to put ourselves on record as supporting that for many of the reasons previous witnesses have raised. Our concern is that an unintended consequence of Senate Bill 42 may be to provide the agency the appearance of a financial incentive to reclassify in-home care providers as adult foster care providers. We believe that ensuring that frail and vulnerable Oregonians, that frail and vulnerable Oregonians should receive the highest quality care possible in the most appropriate setting, and as Mr. Lane pointed out, in the least restrictive setting. And really, you know, the folks who do this work and who have it in their hearts to provide this sort of care should not live in poverty. We've worked hard to help in-home care providers and nursing home workers improve care, but also improve working conditions in their field. In just 6 years, home care providers have increased their wages from $7.20 an hour to over $9 an hour. They're now covered by workers' compensation insurance, so if they're injured on their job, they have some protection. If they consistently work more than 80 hours per month, they earn health insurance for themselves and the right to purchase it for their families. They've paid training and they've paid time off when before there was none. And the legislature made all this possible by funding their contracts, so thank you. Now, care providers in our union have made the commitment to help other caregivers raise standards in their portion of the care continuum. Adult foster care providers really play a critical role in the care continuum and provide options and choices for consumers that they don't have in other states. In regard to our narrow piece of it, DHS has started to reclassify some in-home caregivers as adult foster care providers. And one of the byproducts of this reclassification is to lower wages and deny health care for some caregivers. Senate Bill 42 may have the unintended consequence of enlarging the pool of in-home caregivers for whom reclassification becomes financially more attractive. Agency management and the union agree that there's been a reduction in the number of in-home care providers, I believe also in the number of hours provided to our clients. And we're working together to determine the root causes of these problems. We have a really positive relationship with the agency and with agency management, definitely not casting aspersions on their intentions in any sort of way. We just have this disagreement. We're trying to figure out what exactly is going on. The right way, though, to resolve the broader issue is to raise the standards for those who provide care in the adult foster home setting. I mean, clearly, you've heard from folks it's a labor of love, but it shouldn't just be a labor of love. I mean, people ought to, if they choose this course, should be able to feed their own families and make ends meet. Again, they feel just a really valuable need in our communities. So Senate Bill 42 may be the right way to address the very valid concern that you've heard today. Just please take care to fix this problem without exacerbating this other issue. Thank you very much.
No, I'll wait till work session. No, I won't. I guess I'm reading this and I'm not seeing... I'm not. You've expressed a concern that I don't see here. I just don't see it. I mean, the issues you're talking about may be real issues, but it's not what this bill's about. And what I see is a correction. Just simply a correction. And I know we need to be. We need to be careful about language, and we should always be somewhat suspicious in this building. I understand that, but I've tried to see where this allows the department to go where you want to go, and I'm unless I'm missing something, I don't see it there. So,
Senator Morse, Senator Cruz, I think you're right, but we're just wanting to be very cautious because. The way that the language is written, as I read it, is relatively open-ended, about the same way that Senator Verger read it, I believe. And again, we think everything's going to be fine. We just want to be careful because the, let me see if I can give you an example, if you'll indulge me. Say I'm caring for you, and right now, as an in-home caregiver, you're living in my home, and you get 6 hours of care per day, okay? And supposing you, because you're living in my home, you get reclassified as an adult into adult foster care, and right now you would be required to have 24 hours of care per day. But under the proposed change, if the rule went through, in certain circumstances, you might be eligible for fewer hours per care. And now the difference in reimbursement for in-home care versus adult foster care becomes a little bit more dramatic. And so, again, it's not that big of a deal. And everything should work out just fine. It's just that the appearance is there because the financial difference is greater, that you could see a cascading of people falling into this category. Don't think it'll happen. Don't not, you know, overly worry about, but did just want to get on the record and register that this could be a concern, if that makes sense.
Yeah, just follow up, Ms. Chair. And I appreciate most bills I look at. I am concerned about them as well, about unintended consequences. And as Senator Morissette talked about, the House version that may be in some ways more prescriptive. I'm not sure what the amendment's going to do, but I'm looking at this and I'm saying all we're trying to do is return to status quo. And if we have a program that's been working, I don't want to put sideboards on it that are unnecessary. So part of what I think we've got on the record, what this is intended to do, the department is very clear on what this is intended to do. They help craft it. So I really don't have any concerns.
This is actually, you raised a question that I actually would like Gary then to respond to. When back in the old days when things were right, and you left for an hour, are you charged hourly or are you salary? I mean, so.
Okay, first off, you need to separate in your mind. In-home care workers are people, let's say one of us has some medical problems, we're elderly, or we got injured in an auto accident, we need a little help with bathing or maybe shopping or just cooking a little bit. In-home care workers, which is primarily what SEIU is representing as members of their union, they would come in for an hour, half an hour, 8 hours, one or more days a week, or even a month, and help out. Adult foster care providers.
And that's you.
That's the kind of work that the bill is largely addressing.
Yes.
Have their own home. Disabled people live in our home every at last second of the year. And that's our home. They get medicine from us. We care for them, make sure they're clean. The medication needs are taken care of and other medical ones. And we are paid compensation for it at a rate that is usually less than the hourly minimum hourly wage that the state and federal people want people to earn per hour. But that's another issue. But that's just to make sure that you understand there's a difference between adult foster care providers and in-home care workers. So if he has language he's found where there's some muddling of those terms, that probably should be addressed. I didn't see it in the versions I saw.
Okay.
Yeah, that clarified.
Okay.
I had the same concerns that Senator Kruse did.
Okay. All right.
And if I can respond, Senator Morissette, Senator Miles Anderson, I'll agree up and down the line. And it's just that in some of our situations, in the situation that Mr. Lane described, the client we're caring for lives in the in-home caregiver's home. Okay? And so what happens is because they're residing in the home of the worker, they can be reclassified into the program that Mr. Lane describes. And so, yes, there's a distinction, but that reclassification is starting. And maybe there's good reasons for the reclassification, and maybe there's not. But right now there's a financial incentive to do that, or the appearance of a financial incentive, and that raises the anxiety level for us.
Now, do spouses, this is the program that spouses qualify as an in-home caregiver.
And relatives.
Relatives.
Well, and, you know, and other sorts of arrangements, you know, neighbors taking in neighbors, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, the reclassification would happen, if there's a trend or if it's happening,
right.
It happens with or without this bill. So, I mean, all this bill is to clarify that situation.
That's right.
We're almost dealing with, you're talking about a separate issue to a large degree here.
Senator Cruz, Senator Moore said yes. To a large degree, we are. The way I feel that this proposed law brushes up against our situation. Again, that's why we're in favor of the bill. Again, let me reiterate. We support the legislation. We just wanted to draw this issue out. Thank you.
That just to show there's no perfect world, right?
Sorry.
No. Okay, let me rephrase that. I think that points out that it's very difficult to draw a bill, because there are some extenuating circumstances, and some of them are more imminent than others. When you're raising an issue that is a possibility, it hopefully will never happen, but it's a possibility, is what you're saying.
And I don't want to take up your time today, but I'll get out to your offices testimony from our members before the Home Care Commission, where this has happened, where they have been reclassified, lost their health insurance, and been put in some horrible situations. And so that piece is already going on. So again, don't want to mess this up at all. Just want to flag this as an issue. Want to be supportive of work with the foster home providers to, again, improve standards in their industry and take care of this problem as well.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Do good.
Others wishing to testify? I see no one other wishing to testify. We will close the public hearing, and we will open a work session. Comments on the bill?
On the motion?
We'll have the motion, and we'll discuss.
I move Senate Bill 42 to the floor of the Senate with the DPAS recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to move Senate Bill 42 to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. Comments? Concerns? Okay, seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Mondes Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 42. We'll go to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and I will carry this bill.
Yes, you should.
Yes. Okay. The next bill that we're going to hear, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 144. Who will be? Oh, here we are. You want to give a brief summary?
Senate Bill 144 changes the name of the Radiologic Technology, the Board of Radiologic Technology, to the Board of Medical Imaging Technology. It defines medical imaging technology and expands definitions to include new medical imaging technologies and medical imaging specialists.
Looks like our panel has assembled. Who would like to lead off?
Good afternoon, Senator Morissette and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to come before you today. My name is Linda Russell. I'm the director for the Board of Radiologic Technology.
Very good, Linda.
Today I brought with me Lorraine and Thomas King, and they have a few words that they'd like to extend to you. Okay. Briefly, as it was already explained, most of this bill is more or less housekeeping issues. It's bringing the board current with today's radiology world or world of imaging. Departments are no longer called radiology departments. They're medical imaging services, centers. That's kind of the phrase that's actually used in today's standards, and the reason being is that there are other modalities that have come to life since our board was created in 1977, and some of those we're also asking for authority to bring those modalities on board and Currently, they are not actually regulated or licensed in the state of Oregon, and so we were asked last session to bring this forward, to look into it, bring it forward, and so here we are. Yeah. And one other thing that we have in this bill is also we have a licensing limited scope radiography that we've called or referred to their title as limited permit holder. The national designated title by the professional societies, they call them limited X-ray machine operators. So we're asking to change that name as well.
Any questions?
Yes, you said that something about not being able, not being certified, not being licensed, and who are you referring to?
Senator Morrison and Senator Berger?
Berger.
Thank you. Actually, those modalities that are not currently governed in the state of Oregon are nuclear medicine, magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, as most commonly referred to, and also ultrasound or sonography.
Follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Go ahead.
You mean people who are doing MRIs, sonograms, et cetera, are not being overseen by anyone?
That is correct.
In the state of Oregon?
By no one.
No, by no one.
Not even the hospitals where they work?
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Thomas King. I'm president-elect of the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists. I'm also an employee of Salem Hospital. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, at the present time, in the hospitals alone, not imaging clinics, there are certain protections limited, however, by what formerly was called JCO or now is called the Joint Commission. And in some hospitals, on their own volition, have deemed for quality care wanting to be a magnet institution or what have you to be recognized, have increased their minimum requirements. But in no way is it prohibited. I can walk in off the street one day, and if somebody decided to, well, I'll teach you how to push the buttons. I can transmit energy through your body, maybe not radiation imaging, but I can put you in a magnetic tube and throw energy through your body and produce some images with, chain on the jaw. There's no requirement. And if I may put one more issue, especially for MRI, within this last year, the American Registry of Radiologic Technologies, commonly called ART, who is our credentialing body, has made MRI a primary pathway. In other words, they do not have to be a radiologic technologist. There's specific school and training for MRI. The consequence to this is there is a potential different than I think in radiation. Radiation, and you can get your dosage up, you could probably get cancer or more, or real serious if you walked into a radioactive area with serious stuff. More immediate effects can happen. But an MRI, if you operate that unsafely, if you bring somebody in there with a pacemaker or with some sort of implant that's not on the safe lip, the effects are immediate. People have died in the tube when they shouldn't have. Okay. So,
way to go.
Okay.
People are paranoid enough getting even in the tube.
Getting claustrophobic and then back.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my point here is not to create scare tactics. The point being is to protect your citizens and we have a good thing going with these imaging modalities to discover ways to treat disease earlier. And I just think the citizens of the state of Oregon need to make sure they have some adequate protection.
Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you. You are a member or chair of a board of radiology?
Senator Marcet, Senator Berger, you brought up a very good point. and the reason why we're asking for the name change. I am in the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists. It's the professional society. And for years, we've been confused with the Oregon Board of Radiologic Technology, the OBRT, the one who issues my license to work.
Okay.
We are a professional society that ensures the quality of continuing education and represents the interests of professional technologists in the state.
Mr. Chair, I find the conversation disturbing. I'm not sure of how, as we've improved in getting equipment in into our medical facilities, that there was not some standard set at the same time of those who would operate that equipment. I mean, we have in our family an automobile agency, and we have high standards for people operating computers on your automobile, so, and we're not dealing with your body, so I'm concerned and rather horrified to think that we don't have standards for people operating all kinds of equipment. And I would say particularly the MRI. I'm surprised at that.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee. I think this bill is a very good step in the direction of protecting the citizens of Oregon in this area. I want to mention one other area besides MRI. MRI seems to be, everybody knows about it. You hear a lot about it. Nuclear medicine. Most likely you're going to get somebody with some training. There are several people who've been trained on the job who have not passed the certification test for nuclear medicine who are actively applying active radionuclides to the human body. And I'll just give you a comparison. At Salem Hospital, we hold our standards, everybody will be certified. But in order to receive active nuclear radiating material at our facility, even as a radiologic technologist licensed, I have to go above and take another training and taking a test and get certified simply to receive the active radioactive material from the provider, from the vendor. And yet we have people out there who have gone to job training, not passed the certification board, who are applying that radionuclides to the human body. This bill could address that issue.
I'm looking at the who sponsored the bill. Where did this bill come from?
Senator Morissette, if I might just jump in real quickly.
Sure.
I am the director, but I'm really an administrative director. I'm not a technically skilled person in that respect. However, our board, after last session, mm-hmm. Our board had major changes happen approximately 3 years ago. And with that change came a very active and proactive board.
Mm-hmm.
And they started looking at all of the issues. We started having strategic planning meetings. And I know you saw us here last year, yeah. And we introduced some bills that got us going down the road. And now we looked at the bigger issue. And here we are, because the board feels very passionately about this. We feel that it's wrong not to have these people have some sort of standards, ethical conduct that is required, the education necessary to protect Oregonians. And currently, there just isn't. So the board sponsored the bill. It is supported through the professional society, and we're hoping that the legislature will also support us.
Well, I guess it seems to me that this should have been done a long time ago. There should have been incremental updates as new, you know, categories came into existence and new standards came into existence, and suddenly, you know, here we have a lot of them at once. But it's good. Other questions, yeah. Comments?
Mr. Chair, you know, in one of my health committees last session, we were addressing accountability, and we were finding in cost containment. And we were finding some people feel there's overuse of technology because it's a good way to make money. I hate to put it in those terms, but it is a way for you can make money on it, so to speak. So I am very glad that you are bringing this. We need to hold our health service care providers accountable for what they do, and if there isn't proper training, I share my fellow legislators' sentiment. I'm very, very concerned.
Mm-hmm. Senator George?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. Number one, how many people do you expect will be brought in underneath the board's control?
Chair Morissette, Senator George, since we've not had really any oversight here, Peter John Chin is our public. We have one position on our board that's not a designated position. Mm-hmm. It could be either filled by a modality or it could be filled by public member. Currently, Peter is our public member because we don't have a spot on the board for nuclear medicine technologists. But he also is highly respected and published. He works for Providence, and he has a little few paragraphs in there why he supports the bill. He told me that he thinks that there's approximately 109 nuclear medicine technologists in the state. When I made the fiscal impact, I put in there that in my budget package that possibly we might have $9,600, because our licensing fee for 2 years is $96. That could be a result of this. As far as the ultrasound part of this, I have no way of knowing. Very few of them are certified through ARRT. I went to the websites. I've talked with the individuals there, and they don't have their very large numbers. Most of the RTs that are out, that are trained on the job, that are MRI techs, are already radiologic technologists and licensed through the board. What this bill will do to the licensees of our state is that we will be changing, hopefully, and they will be called medical imaging technologists, and under that then we will specify the different modalities that they are certified in, and that will be done at no additional cost. It will remain the same. So many of them who do the MRI practices on a daily basis are already RTs. So, it's kind of, I wish I could give you better numbers, but I just don't have them.
Mr. Chairman, the reason for that question, and I'm really surprised how little you charge for a two-year license. I just had recently had an MRI scan, and I went over to Washington Square, and I had a hard time finding this place, and I went in there, and just as my doctor told me, found the place, we did the test. I was kind of looking around, license and this sort of thing, and I was wondering, how well this place was managed. So anyway, I got back to my doctor, and I asked, why did you send me to that place? And he said, first of all, they do very, very high-quality work, and I got a chance to see it because they put it on a computer CD, and it was just unbelievable to look at what they had. The other thing is, he said, they're less expensive. This is my question. With additional training that these folks are going to incur, and what appeared to me a totally computer-operated system, the guy basically pushed a button, they ran you in that thing, and you popped back out when you were done. And so my question is, do we expect to have higher cost if, in fact, that my doctor would have had to say, well, no, you're going to have to go to Salem Hospital? And do we have any idea what the comparisons would be between these kind of operations and a normal hospital? Because let me just be very blunt with you. Many times in this building, I come to the conclusion that the reason for many of the boards and commissions is to limit competition to keep prices high. So I want to make sure here that we have a managed industry, but at the same time, and managed and safe industry, but at the same time making sure that new technologies won't be discouraged from coming in here. So help me understand what you're going to do on what I believe is the positive side of new technology.
I have to kind of.
That's a big bunch of questions.
Yeah,
I'm sorry about that.
Sorry.
Chairman Morissette, Senator George. The purpose and why the society is supporting this is purely a safety issue and a quality of care issue. Some of our members don't work in a hospital. They work in a clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We probably have members in the clinic you went to. The issue is to ensure that clinics like yours, hospitals, have at least minimum standards to provide, one, quality in images and protect the safety of the public. And I've seen good images and bad images, and at the present time, if they were going to go through the training to push a button, they need to go through the rest of the training to make sure they'd use the correct parameters. And I have to mention one thing. Mm-hmm. There's in X-ray, there's two parameters you can adjust to get an image: the force of energy used, the amount of radiation you receive. In MRI, there's eight. Okay? And it's all about the field strength, how much energy you're going to put through, which direction of energy you're going to put it through, how long you're going to let that energy sit into flipping the hydrogen atoms, how long you're going to let those atoms echo, and then how much specific absorption rate are you going to allow the body to receive. So there's a constant trade-off on producing those images. So I just wanted to make that mm-hmm. clear. But this is not a money issue. It's more of a quality and safety issue.
Would you like to add something?
My name is Lorraine Vavacqua. I'm a registered technologist and have been a registered technologist in radiography since 1969 and work almost full-time. I'm currently a member. This is my third year on the OBRT as our licensing board. When I came on the board, it was right at the point when the changes were taking place and the whole attitude of the board and new members on the board. I look at what is currently our legislation and our current statutes and laws for requiring individuals that are required of individuals that are providing medical imaging as very, very good as long as all you're handling is X-ray. So in 1977, when a radiology department was probably 95% X-ray and nothing more, this probably, as we see it today in our current legislation, was probably very good. And it addressed the issues. We are no longer there. X-ray probably produces maybe only 25% of the revenue of a radiology department. That would be my personal guess. I don't have statistics to back it up. It's just kind of anecdotal from what I see working. The biggest portion of the revenue that is produced comes from the modalities that are not governed, not licensed, not regulated by this state. Now, my concern is the quality. Every one of these modalities does have in existence a nationally recognized certification organizations, be it through the American Registry of Radiologic Technology in all of the various modalities. There is a separate board or a separate organization for ultrasound. The American, ARDMS, I believe is how it is. That does nothing but ultrasound. They are very good. There is also a similar board for nuclear medicine. This state requires that for me to practice my field of radiography, which means I get to take your X-rays, I have to be credentialed. I have to prove that I have gone through my training and have passed my boards and have kept up my continuing education so that I know that we no longer use wet tanks. We now have digital radiography. Okay. And all of the other things that transpire in between there. And that I have to do that on an annual basis with my registry and a biannual basis with my board and prove that I am current. I can, on the other hand, walk into your medical imaging facility and say, oh, that's a cute machine. Let me see if I can push the buttons. And I don't know a flippin' thing about an MRI unit or an ultrasound probe other than, gee, it makes nice squiggly lines on there. And I am legally allowed to do that.
Now, I'm looking at page 2 and 3 of the bill that defines who and why. How many people are we involving in now?
that are not
includes magnetic resonance imaging technologist, medical sonographer, nuclear medicine technologist. I mean, all of those are
those are the ones
going to be.
That's correct, sir.
So, and okay, minute then section 13. Alphabetically list them, then we go to section, let's see, then we go to 14, not section, but subsection, then we go to 14, and then there are some additional ones, I think.
Are we still on, I'm sorry, Senator Morissette,
I'm not
calling where you're at.
Well, I'm on page
2
and 3.
Page 2 and 3, okay.
Single photon emission, wow. So how many in total do we have at our new...
Senator Morissette, what we will be looking at is the MRI technologists.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be looking at the nuclear medicine technologists.
Okay.
And we'd be looking at the sonographers. Those are the three areas that we have absolutely no regulations over in this state.
I have another question, but it's unrelated to what I just asked. Did you want to go ahead?
Why hasn't the hospital here, they do quite a few of their referrals and physicians and OMA, why not they here to testify regarding this? I mean, I really feel that they are usually the ones that refer, correct? And do they refer only to do they usually refer to licensed imaging or some people maybe just want to go in and have an image taken without being referred. I think you need to explain a little bit to me.
Well,
who can get
an exam?
Yeah.
Chairman Morissette and Senator Anderson. it's kind of a wide question there. If you're a Medicare recipient, you know, you're not going to get reimbursement unless you have a physician order. There's certain aspects of that. And as far as the clinics go, there's some muddled water on the federal level with Stark legislation about self-referral. There is currently ways around that where physicians can refer to certain clinics. And there were some reimbursement going back to that physician. There's an attempt on the federal level to correct that. In fact, there was recently this year that reimbursement was lowered to freestanding clinics over that issue. It's not so much in the hospital. Our cost in the hospital side of things is we must remain staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whereas a clinic can, you know, 8 to 5 or whenever you have your appointments, you're done. And so we have certain costs in the hospital side. I don't know if that's answering your question now, but certain costs in the hospital side that maybe be higher than you would in a clinic only because of the nature of our business and the type of patients that we serve. As far as the people operating equipment in the clinics, up to this point, for the most part, it's been RTs on the job trained. But there's no guarantees they're being supervised by anybody who's been certified in MRI. And maybe it's the manufacturer's rep that comes by and gives them a week hands-on and then call it good. And that's mainly our concern.
So just follow up. So this bill brings in some people that will now be out of work because it's... They're not licensed? No. Okay.
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson. I'll get it right yet. Thank you. I'm sorry. No, we were very careful to make sure that no one would be out of work. I worked really closely with legislative counsel when we went through this and drafted it to make sure that the grandfather clause was in there and that none of our technologists that have been trained on the job are going to be out of a job because of this. What Thomas and the other members of the society have kind of informed the board about is that the natural regression of like ART and the certification, they're just narrowing that gap, and sooner or later what they're doing is they allow these individuals to sit for the registry and pass the certification exam without the formal education. So they have the opportunity to become certified if they so choose to. And that's being done all over the place as far as the registry is concerned. And I think that even nuclear medicine, the nuclear, let's see, I've got to get the initials right, NMTCB is the other certifying body for nuclear medicine. They also are allowing individuals to sit for their certification who have been trained over time but haven't had the actual formal education. Thomas had explained how they're starting up some of the, rather than going through the 2 and 4 year colleges for radiologic technologists, now they're coming up with just a fast accelerated program in just MRI or some of the other specialized modalities. And so the world of radiography has changed so drastically that I know this is not a humble attempt at what should have been done, could have been done, but we feel, or the board feels, very strongly that there's a need to have oversight. We need to be able to know that the individuals that are taking and giving imaging services out in the community all over the community in Oregon, that they have the education, okay, whether it's on the job training or that they do have and have become certified, or they go through some of these specialized schools down the road and just take that specialty, but that there's oversight there.
Okay, what do you mean by all over the place? How do you define all over the place? No, seriously, is that national, state, what?
Here, Chairman Morissette, there's moves to make some national recommendations for minimum standards. There are some states. Oregon actually is with this bill would probably be a benchmark state, as there are various levels of licensure in different states now, and there's 13 states in this country that have absolutely zero licensing.
Okay. So what you're saying then is that it's not uncommon for on-the-job training to be the basis for a license and so on. It's interesting because last session we had a bill that would allow X-ray technicians in a dentist office to learn on the job rather than have to go through the community college training, which was interesting because I had 3 X-rays taken when the first 2 didn't come out right, and I was wondering if I was.
Chair Morissette, may I please make one comment here? We do not have any oversight over the dental board.
Well, no, but I mean, it's on-the-job training is okay, but I guess there are standards that they have to achieve and show proficiency and so on. There is one other question that I want to ask about your board, and that is in terms of oversight. I know you have the standard language that you can, for unethical behavior and so on and so on and so on. How many are you active? Do you have a track record of dealing with complaints in a timely manner? Do you want to talk about that briefly?
Senator Morissette, I've sat in a board meetings now for almost 3 years, and every time the first almost half day is spent going through what we call investigations.
Okay.
Anybody, public or anybody, can bring a complaint to us, and we are obligated to have to see if there's really anything to it.
Okay.
Anybody who holds a license with our board is required to bring a problem to us if they see it happening. If they see somebody taking an X-ray who doesn't have a license, they are required to bring it to us, because if we find out they didn't, then we go after their license as well. At our last meeting, which was just last week, we took the license away of one tech. At the meeting prior to that, we took the license away of one tech. And we also went after a commercial facility who was employing an unregistered and non-licensed techs. We have AG office representation during our investigations and our executive sessions, who's there to help make sure that we don't step on any landmines. And we will go after, and we do go after, anybody who is breaking those rules. Now, we have gone after people for misconduct. We have gone after people for inappropriate acts in the professional area, and we have gone after people for practicing without a license and companies who employ them, and we will continue to do so until you tell us we are not allowed to, but we will do so.
I think we would want you to do it in a more, well, not a more timely, but I think it's good to do, and it's good to report this. Do you have any open cases that you have not resolved, that you can't resolve, that you're just, that's sitting around somewhere?
Chair Morissette, currently, last year, we had 15 cases.
Okay.
The previous year, I dwindled it way down as far as the caseload. Currently, we do not, well, I do too. I take that back. We have two cases that just came before the board. It hasn't gone, it'll be at our April meeting, but they're cases that we're developing in the office right now. But we're current on everything.
Yeah.
And, 2 months ago, everyone became certified and we started implementing LEADS background checks for the state of Oregon on all of our licensees for their renewal and initial applications. We are also co-sponsored with DCBS on the fingerprints so that those radiologic technologists that are travelers and come in to replace workers while they're on vacation and such, that we could, if the need be, do a background check, fingerprints on them, or also for multiple state offenders. LEADS background checks are great. They're fabulous as long as the person has resided in Oregon for, you know, a period of, I think, at least 6 months or even 2 years is kind of that benchmark.
Okay.
So I kind of think that maybe the 15 cases that we looked at this last year, that might rise slightly over the next two-year full cycle, because we do monthly birth renewals. So it really takes us that two-year span to go through everyone. That might rise, but I think after that point, all of those little things that were never reported, what we're finding now are things like a DUI that someone didn't report. Not necessarily that a lot of them, not that they wouldn't have reported it, but there's this misunderstanding that that when you go through a diversion program that it's dismissed, but it truly isn't dismissed. It's still on your record unless you have it expunged. And so it's working with our licensees to let them know and bringing that all forward, but we are doing it timely.
Okay, good. That I just wanted to ask that question because you're bringing new people on, and I was just kind of curious about your oversight. Any other questions?
No, you have nothing at all to do with radiology in the treatment of cancer.
Senator Morissette, Senator Berger, our current board is the Board of Radiologic Technology, and it encompasses both radiographers who take your x-ray and radiation therapy technologists who provide you your treatments in your cancer centers using radiation. So yes, those two areas we do license currently and have since 1977.
So those standards have been there for a long time.
Correct.
Just briefly, can you explain to me why these other areas have just fallen through and not had anything done about them? Has there been pushback from people that are involved in those areas, that they haven't wanted this, or what has kept it from being? I mean, this is, they've been doing these imaging for a long time, so why are we now in 2007 bringing this up?
And Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, if I might, going back to just a few years ago, the board had a director who took upon themselves to keep the board unaware of things that were going on. The business never came before the board, as far as I can see it. It takes a lot of work to come before you. And when you're a small board, administratively like we are, I can kind of maybe understand the why someone wouldn't want to put the work involved into it. But it's a pretty lame excuse, to be honest with you. So I think that it's the board really didn't know what was going on. And I think that during this time frame, I can't speak from before, but I know I've been with the board since 1998, and I worked almost 2.5 years under the previous director. And so I'm aware of what went on and what I was directed to do and not do. So I speak honestly when I say that. I'm not trying to, you know, get anybody in trouble or not tell the truth, but I think that the board didn't take action where these other modalities were concerned, because I think it's the director's position to bring things to the board and ask. What I try to do is I bring issues to them and I do pros and cons so that they can make a sound policy decision. They're a policy making board, and I really think that led to some of this. I can't speak from the technical side, and I'm sure that Thomas or Lorraine can, but I mean, I can see that from within our board itself.
Just to follow up on a comment, this field has just mushroomed, and I think that has a lot to do with it, too. Before, it was just x-rays, and now, with the new technology, it is getting so good, so precise. And now there's a public demand for that also. So part of the problem is it has grown so fast, and institutions are sort of slow in adapting to the medical progress that we've made, or technology progress that we've made. So I think that may be part of the problem. It's not an excuse, I'm glad we're taking the first steps, but I think there needs to be a whole lot more done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on the purpose of the bill, second page, it says, encompassing additional authority through governance, licensure of nuclear medicine, ultrasound, and magnetic resource, resonance imaging. So you have had some control over that. What if I read that correctly, that last half of the sentence? So explain to me if you have had some governance authority over, because you're increasing the authority, additional authority, over nuclear medicine. I mean, really, how much input, how much control have you guys had, and over ultrasound and magnetic imaging?
Okay. Chairman Morrison and Senator George, the, quote, authority that the state of Oregon has over nuclear medicine is based in Radiation Protection Services, and their rules, Radiation Protection Services, controls things like the machinery and the facilities.
And they don't regulate operators?
And they do not regulate operators. They will tell you, if you bring in your radioactive materials, if it's being stored properly, if it's spilled, if it's handled properly, if it's disposed of properly and half-life properly. But it doesn't say that who can do it, including the janitor. He can be in a plane in the hot lab. So it doesn't say anything about who can do it. It just says how it has to be done. And basically the national regulations that come from National Radiation NRC, mm-hmm. basically, at the national level, their regulations are very similar to that. They say what you have to do with things, not
with the equipment, not the personnel, the operator.
That's correct. There is, at this time, the same thing goes for your ultrasound equipment.
Right.
Your ultrasound equipment, depending upon what your application is, has to be a certain sound wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as your equipment is doing that, that's anybody can play with it. Okay. That's pretty much where we're at.
and there are no restrictions, Mr. Chair, if I can, there are no restrictions. You know, for example, the some of the testimony that we're looking at with Tom and his wife, there's no restrictions of the amount of exposure you could put on a fetus with an ultrasound if you had the device. It's currently in Oregon.
Right now, I don't know how many of you have heard about the Tom Cruise bill.
That's what I was reading, yes.
Yes, you like the Tom Cruise bill. He liked to look at his baby. It was his pastime. He would just sit there and play with this. There are some very scary things being discovered about ultrasound, which we have thought for the last 25 years have been very safe. But, of course, we used to think radiation was very safe, too. We used to have fluoroscopes in Buster Brown's shoe stores where we could watch our feet wiggle inside of our shoes.
We used to play there.
Yes, we used to play there. Well, Tom Cruise is doing the same thing with ultrasound on his baby, and the state of California went ballistic, and thank God they put a stop to it. But we don't really know. There are studies that are being done now that they're in England where they are collecting data from the last 25 years of people and going back and comparing these people's mental status with their exposure, prenatal exposure to ultrasound, and finding a direct correlation from things like autism, ADD, attention deficit disorder, and even schizophrenia. And the more ultrasound exposure there is, the higher incidence they're finding. Now, this is very, very new research, so there's still a lot of questions on it, but it's kind of scary in its own right. If you have a truly qualified sonographer, they're going to tell you you're going to do your job as quickly as possible with minimal time exposure, and you are not going to do it before the fetus is approximately 12 weeks, because if you do it, the earlier you do it, the more chance you are of literally cooking the fetus.
Could I get that question answered? Are you telling me there are no regulations as to the amount of time that an operator in Oregon can...
No. No, sir, there are not. In
I'm
going to
get
right
a headache again. I can feel the headache coming.
Well, there
is an organization right now, and you can go on their website, that's in Ontario, Oregon, that calls itself Keepsake Sonography.
Sure.
And they do 3D, which is three-dimensional still shots, and 4D, which is three-dimensional live video of these babies. And they will spend an hour, if necessary, to get you a good face shot of the baby so you can take it home and show it to your friends.
Okay. I'm thinking of an administrative rule that might correct that rather than statutory language, are we?
Well, Mr. Chair.
We have to be able to regulate them first.
Pardon me?
Yes.
Yeah. Chair Morissette, we have to be able to regulate them.
I know,
them first.
But I'm saying we could send this bill back and you could amend it and to regulate them. We can regulate them, but then there are other things that we're going to need to do. And if we can do some administratively in the meantime, that would help. Are we ready to move on this bill?
Yes.
Do we want to go ahead?
One question. With all these changes, are you going to be coming back to us 2 years from now to change the makeup of the board to recognize these other disciplines?
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, I believe that we've addressed that in our board makeup and said that we wish this board to be representative of the population that it basically is going to be looking at. So we don't want to have all radiographers telling sonographers and nuclear medicine and MRI techs how to do their job.
Okay,
where
is that in the bill?
It was way at the very end of the bill. I haven't read it.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, we addressed this when we last go around, last session. We actually, one of our bills increased the number of board members from 7 to 9. One was for the limited permit licensee, which we've licensed since the beginning, and they had no representation on the board. So that was one of the positions. The other one is the one that I spoke of Peter Chin, which is not a designated one. So, in other words, it could be another public member if the board chose to, or it could be filled by one of these other modalities. We're just very fortunate right now that Peter Chin happens to be a nuclear medicine technologist. So he has really been an asset to the board.
Okay, let me rephrase my statement question. Are we ready to act on this bill, or do we need to take a little bit more time, take a look at it, and come back and ask more questions? We will pass this bill. I'm sure we're going to pass this bill, but, you know, it's somewhat complicated. Do we need to look at it some more?
Senator Morissette, I would vote for more time.
Okay.
Chair, we were talking, and this is necessary. There's no question. I don't think a few days is going to matter, but but I would like to get some feedback from the rest of the medical community on this.
Laura?
Yes. I would like to get input from hospitals, from providers.
And I'm also looking at other kinds of oversight that we might look at in terms of the ones that are not currently regulated. If we do regulate them, do we need more oversight?
Mr. Chair, this is shocking, to say the least. Yeah. I mean, it truly is.
And it looked like such a simple bill. No, it didn't. It didn't look like a simple bill. It had lots in it, and so it
Chair Morris said it is a simple bill. We're simply asking to be able to regulate them. However, I do understand what you're saying here. But just to kind of ease your mind, this was a legislative concept that the board introduced back in January of 2006. Mm-hmm. Since then, we have had this on our website. It has been there for the whole world to see in its entirety.
If somebody looks at your website.
But it's right on the very front page under current topics.
How many people bother to look at your website?
Well, the thing is that our board members have talked to the people in the hospitals and their clinics, and you know, I wish I had a whole group here today to that could answer these questions.
Well,
but, you know, we just haven't had any.
To your credit, you have raised some very important issues.
Yeah.
To your credit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I think that we need to just take some time to take, you know, to look at
diligence.
It and do our due diligence and ask questions and so on. Now, you know, we visited the oncology center in Lane County, and they do all kinds of work there. The trend is to open your little clinics here and there. The trend is to buy this latest equipment, and people, you know, Dr. Bates said there's enough MRI machines in Ashland to take care of all of southern eastern Oregon, northern California. So there is a proliferation of machines as well as technology. So there's new technology. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to tell you the truth, though. When I think back, when I walked in there a few, you know, a month or so ago to do that MRI, before I climbed in that tunnel, I was thinking, this is a regulated industry, isn't it? I mean,
you didn't know.
Because I was thinking, you know, I would have probably not gone in there because I was looking on the wall for my credentials and I wasn't seeing them. Right. And the whole time I'm getting warm in my little tunnel, I'm thinking, I hope this is okay.
One more on. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, just a point of information here. On a national level, I'm going to Capitol Hill in March for a reintroduction of the CARE bill. That's a consumer excellence in radiology, and they're probably going to call it a different name, to bring federal minimum standards. They're probably not going to address everything here, but there is a movement afoot to take a look at this, especially in such states like Mississippi and South Dakota, where there's absolutely no regulation whatsoever. So we're going to be looking at that. We have the support of the American College of Radiology as well.
Okay. And you said earlier this would be kind of benchmark legislation. If Oregon should adopt this, then that's something that would set some standards.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, yes, we would be kind of on the leading edge of this, because what we're looking at is this is the type of thing that is being talked about and pushed about in little fits and starts all over the country by our national society, the ASRT, by our national registry, ART, and by the various other credentialing boards, and the CARE bill being a big portion of it. Eventually, the CARE bill or some type of bill of that type is going to happen, and that will mandate that states have to do this. or something along these lines. And what we're one of the things that we're looking at is that if we do it ahead of the curve, by golly, they can look at us as or look to us to be a leader rather than wondering why we're following, which would be kind of nice. Mm-hmm. It would be to be ahead of the curve instead of playing to play catch up. And it would really be wonderful if we could do that.
But, Mr. Chair, I just, and maybe you can't be candid, but I would think maybe like hospitals would be opposed to this because that means this will lead to them having to, it'll be difficult for them to find trained medical imaging technicians. Do you think that is an issue? It'll be interesting to hear what they have to say. Let's put it that way.
Senator Morrison, Senator Anderson, the hospitals are probably not going to be the ones who would be opposed to it because they are already after credentialed people because of the Joint Commission.
Okay,
the JCO and Joint Commission.
All right.
So they are already after credentialed people, at least well-trained, mm-hmm. if they aren't credentialed, and are pushing more toward that. The freestanding clinics, the self-referring clinics that want it done as cheap as possible because they can have their sister-in-law come on in or their secretary hop on over.
Gotcha.
They're the ones that you're probably going to hear.
Okay. This helps clarify. Thank
we're
you.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We will reschedule and revisit. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have one more issue to deal with. But let's deal with 60 and 61 together, if that's possible.
You must be missing something.
This was what? This is for this bill.
Mm-hmm. I know.
How could all of this?
Because of my fear of liability.
Then notice. I don't know. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it is.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
I never would have thought. Yeah, there's only so much savings I'm going to go for.
Okay, hi. Kathleen and John, would you introduce yourselves, please?
Thank you, Chair Morissette. For the record, I'm John Fletcher, and I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. And we're here together. This is Kathleen Joy, who is the executive director of the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. This commission is part of our department, sort of. They're an independent commission, but they're connected with the department, and so the department sponsored the bill, and we work with the commission on a regular basis. So we're here together. And this isn't going to be a complicated nuclear medicine kind of bill. This, I'm sure, we can present quickly for your consideration, and I'll try to be brief. First of all, Senate Bill 60 is a bill about volunteerism. And we know about volunteers in our community. We have volunteers that help on the softball team and volunteers that help at the PTA and at Head Start. Many of you probably had volunteers working on your campaigns. And many of us have all volunteered in different ways in our community. When we volunteer, it helps the community, but it helps us. We grow closer to the issues. We might be helping on a food drive, and we gain a greater appreciation for those that are in need. I mean, there's many ways that we volunteer. There is a statewide commission that helps to encourage volunteerism throughout the state, and that is this long-named commission, the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. And we're going to refer to them today as the Oregon Volunteers Commission just for being a little more brief and getting out of here on time. So the Oregon Volunteers Commission works with volunteer groups and agencies throughout the state, and they have a committee where they get input from all these organizations they work with, and this committee gathered data about what can we do in Oregon to encourage volunteers in our communities so that our communities can be stronger. And some of the ideas that came forward, they are implementing through their strategic plan. And one of the ideas that is coming forward relates to studying the best practices of other states when it comes to volunteerism. And it is one of those ideas that we have before us, and the legislature can help with one small part of this overall volunteer effort, and that's Senate Bill 60. Senate Bill 60, really quickly, provides a statement that the legislature supports and promotes volunteerism. It's a policy statement. That's important to recognize. It's almost obvious. We have statewide benchmarks, but having an actual statement is a affirmation of support from the legislature. So that's one part in Section 2.1 that provides that statement of support. Another part of this bill directs the Oregon Volunteers Commission to set goals, and it lists 10 areas. That's important for the commission now so that they can focus where they're going to be working, but it's also important for future commissions when the membership rotates so that we can be sure to try to work in all these important areas with respect to volunteerism. Another area of this bill requires the commission to come back and report to the legislature on how they're doing. And that report, I think, would be of interest to the legislature as well as its good accountability for the commission. So these are the major provisions of the bill. This bill was fashioned after legislation already adopted in Florida and Massachusetts, where they made these policy statements. And they have found that as part of this policy statement and other efforts, that they've seen volunteerism go forward at greater levels in their state. So we're hoping to do the same in Oregon. That concludes my summary of Senate Bill 60, and be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a fiscal impact? Is this going to cost more money?
There's no fiscal impact associated with Senate Bill 60 or Senate Bill 61.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to ask that question. Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions? Senator Virgil.
Chair, I don't have a question, but I'd like to make a statement. I think that Oregon probably has a role model for a volunteer organization in SOLV, SOLV, with their beach cleanup, which has affected my part of the state and has grown to be a considerable effort. I don't know what that might cost if you had to pay for it.
That's correct.
And it's a wonderful, wonderful example. Not that there aren't many around Oregon, but SOLV stands out in my mind because I'm from the coast. And I just want to say that about volunteerism in Oregon. And I don't know anything that you could say negative about the kind of work that has been done by people that we could never accomplish if we had
you
to pay for it.
Chair Morissett and Senator Berger, we actually wanted to acknowledge a little bit more. Kathleen, do you want to?
I would say, Senator Virgil, Kathleen Joy, Executive Director of Oregon Volunteers, Chair Morissette, Senator Virgil, one of the things that we've got in this bill, Section 2J, to recognize the importance of individual volunteers and volunteer service. We had the pleasure last October 5th of bringing back the Governor's Volunteer Awards in Oregon, which hadn't been given for 14 years. And Senator Virgil was with us because her daughter was recognized from the region. And that was a very happy day for us to start to bring volunteerism into the forefront. And I wanted to follow up a little bit. Our State Committee on Volunteerism is composed composed of representatives from most of the major volunteer groups in the state, certainly includes SOLV volunteer centers. When they were doing their feasibility studies and surveying and planning, the major thing that we heard from people across the state is that they yearn for greater recognition and understanding of the work that's being done by volunteers by people in state and local government. And I think that this bill allows you to codify some wonderful things that have been happening and will continue to happen through volunteerism.
My concern is that the state is not putting enough money to train volunteers and to sustain volunteerism, because that's essential. If we don't have coordinators, then it's very difficult to recruit and train and retain.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, we actually 2 years ago started our first foray into a certification program for training volunteer managers to train other volunteer managers. It was a first attempt. We do this basically with almost no budget funding that comes into us through the Corporation for National Service that is primarily designated to support national service programs like AmeriCorps and Senior Corps programs, but we're able to bring in a few more people. I would heartily agree with you that more sustainability is necessary, and that's a large part of what I believe will happen with the passage of this bill, that like Florida, which ratcheted up its number of volunteer centers by over 200%, and the number of volunteers involved in disaster relief in Florida by over 10,000 once they pass this bill, that we can see that same sort of momentum happening in Oregon.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Now,
we have one more bill?
Yeah.
We could do it really quickly if you have time.
Well, I'm sorry that, yes, we definitely will do it, and we didn't.
Okay.
Put this down for the work session, which we
That's
probably
correct.
Should have. But you're here. We'll get the information, and then we will reschedule
right.
For a work session. But go on, yes. Let's
Thank you,
the
sir.
Bill.
Senate Bill 61 is addressing the question of background checks, criminal background checks on the volunteers that offer their service. It's kind of a dilemma. You want to make sure that you have good volunteers that are working to keep the people that they're serving safe. But at the same time, many organizations that use volunteers do so because they're free and they can't afford to be hiring a lot of people. And so the costs of the criminal background checks are an issue in many of these situations. So the way that we're trying to address this issue is to have the Oregon Commission, Volunteers Commission, study the best practices in other states when it comes to volunteers. And then the bill also directs that they will conduct outreach education to organizations so that they're aware of what can be done and what the best practices might be for certain situations. This bill does not actually require any organization to incur the costs of all these background checks. It stops short of that. First, we're going to study those best practices and make those recommendations at a later time when all the due diligence has been done. This bill is patterned after the Ohio bill, which also has a similar statute now, in which they are following these same steps towards a policy for volunteerism. There is one bill that will maybe come before the Senate at some point in this session, House Bill 2041. This has been introduced by the Interim House Committee on Education, and that deals with background screening for volunteers working in the schools. This is a bill addressing volunteerism in many other areas that have slipped through the cracks where we don't currently have law. This bill does not have a fiscal, and it is supported by the state police, who do the background criminal investigations. They're in favor of us finding out these best practices for volunteers and then making those that information available throughout the state. So we would ask for your support on that bill as well, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
This was, Mr. Chair, this was these were easy bills.
Well, yeah, they were.
Very important.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I'm not objecting. Once again, this is looking for unintended consequences in the future. My only concern is if we're setting a framework here to where we're going to make background checks mandatory for all volunteer organizations, and for some of the... It isn't here. I understand that.
Okay.
It's not here. I understand that. But that could be an incredible burden on some of our small volunteer organizations. And
exactly.
And not that it's not necessarily a good idea. It truly is, especially when you're dealing with people that are working with kids. But... because sometimes the wrong people are attracted to that sort of thing, and I understand that. We just need to be very careful as we proceed out into the future that we aren't going to make undue hardships on a lot of volunteer organizations.
I'm trying to think of the name of the volunteer group for seniors.
RSVP.
RSVP.
Yes. And right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to say that's one that they were having problems keeping the staffing to train people, and that to me seemed like
that's
a no-brainer. I mean, you have to provide the support to keep the volunteer crew going. Senator Murphy, you had...
Yes, Chair, one of the problems that occurs, and I agree with Senator Cruz, it's just a shame that we have to do this in our society, but... we have to also be realistic in that we have lots of new people moving into our coastal areas, and they've not lived there any period of time, and they would like to be involved, and we want them to be involved, mm-hmm. but we know absolutely nothing about them. And so if they volunteer, and particularly where they're dealing either with very elderly or with very young children.
That's right.
And so I think that the only way to go is to just do some type of background check to try to protect. And I don't think, even with background checks, quite frankly, that we're going to be able to weed out people that are fairly stable and have stable jobs. You've just been looking at television this week with an individual who has been at one job 25 years. So mm-hmm. a lot of those things don't tell you a lot about what people are capable of. But I think that the caution, we better go on the side of caution.
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger makes a good point. Senator Cruz makes a good point. That's why this is a delicate issue, and that's why we need to study the best practices carefully, and that's what this bill is intended to do.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I wasn't voicing opposition. I was just voicing caution.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Excellent point.
Okay, good. Then we will close the public hearing, and we will adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you.